Hello, I'm Elena Del Val, and this is the HispanicNPR.com podcast. My guest today is Tony D'Urso, who is co-author of Imen of Atlantis Bitten and Imen of Atlantis Ruthless. We will discuss how he became a fiction writer. Tony is the host of the Tony D'Urso Show, a podcast that, according to his bio, has amassed over 45 million downloads in 7 years. Tony has become a voice in the podcasting world. His fiction novel, The Imen of Atlantis Bitten, is set in a mythical land inspired by ancient maps of the Arctic. The book explores a powerful race of beings with extraordinary abilities, whose existence sparks a dangerous greed for gold and power among humans. Tony, welcome.
Elena, thank you so much for having me on the Hispanic Marketing and Public Relations podcast. It is an honor to be here. I know what it takes to interview people and host and be the host, so I just want to give you my sincere appreciation to be on your lovely show.
Thank you. Before we kick off our discussion, please share a conflict of interest statement with us.
My name is Tony D'Urso, and I speak for myself and also for my author of my fiction series. My author is listed on the book as SKR, and I speak for both of us when talking about the book.
Tell us, Tony, how did this come about? Because you mainly dwell in the nonfiction space in your podcast, and I think in your previous writing, right?
Yes, Elena. I am known for as a nonfiction author. I write nonfiction. My podcast is nonfiction. I interview people who are at the top of their category, whom I call elite entrepreneurs. I've written some books such as The Black Book of Sales Secrets, which has nothing to do with magic, but that was just a nice title then. I wrote Easy Sales Procedures. I wrote Elite Entrepreneur. I wrote The Disciplined CEO. So I'm known for nonfiction, serious, you know, how to improve your life, your business, your business life, how to be the CEO, all sorts of things. So to now go into being a fiction writer, it's something that's, you could say, out of character. It's not something that you normally do. And did you want me to go into how that actually started?
Well, some people, for example, I have heard, just wake up and remember a dream, and there's a story in their dream, and they write it. Or some people always wanted to write a book ever since they could remember. And so I think for our listeners who are thinking that they have a book in them, they're looking for inspiration. And perhaps by sharing how this decision came about, it might help them.
Sure, I totally get it. I've wanted to write fiction as a younger person, because, you know, you see movies, you read books, and you go, oh, and then those would inspire stories. I have great stories, but career-wise, I wound up going into, you know, the nonfiction world, the business world, entrepreneurs, and so forth. So writing fiction was never something that that I even wanted to attempt, even though I had, you know, what I considered some very good stories in my head. Well, someone I know very, very well, who is my co-author, SKR, came to me years back with this really great story and wanted help to write and put the book together. And I'm known in my family and friends circle as being very good with English. I'm Italian, by the way. I was born in Sicily. I grew up in Chicago. And by the way, once in a while, my Chicago comes out. You can hear it from my accent, perhaps, even though I've spent most of my life now in the Los Angeles area. So, and I write letters, or I proofread letters, or I help family and friends, you know, with their linguistic needs, just because I've taken so many classes on English. So I was approached to write a fiction. I was like, well, it's not really something I'm known for. I've got all these books on nonfiction. My whole show is nonfiction. This would just be very odd to go do something so different, even though I would love to do it. And my justification is I have a co-author now. So with the co-author on the book, I can now issue a book with the co-author and my name, and I can go into a new field, and I don't have to worry about, hey, Tony, what are you doing writing about something that's fiction? Are you serious or are you not? You know what I mean? It's like if you knew a comedian all your life who now writes some really serious work about how to run business, would you take that person serious because they're known for being a comedian? So I had that concern, and having a co-author kind of helped me bridge that gap. And that also puts me in different circles because, you know, readers and people that like fiction stories. So I thought that was very safe to do, and it worked out really well. We put together The Imon of Atlantis. I'm happy to tell you more about it, a fiction story that's set in, let's call it older world or medieval. Would you take your pick on which word? You know, in this world of Atlantis. And what's nice is that because there is no place today called Atlantis, it opens the doors not only for writing the story, but I actually have a location for it. I actually created, in quotes, where Atlantis resides now. So now we have a territory, we have a location. And it was fun to bring something back to life that people know relatively little about. There is some truth in the book that we feel true things, but it is a fiction story. So, but that's kind of how that started.
What does Imon mean?
Ooh, that is the question. Most people don't ask that. When we first started with the story, we started working on characters and who's who and who's what, and it just kind of lends itself. And we thought, well, what do we call them? Do we, you know, we didn't even know that it was Atlantis then, because it was just the story. You start off with people and they do things, right? And in that character development, we kept thinking of them being a different class of people. Now, this is at the beginning of when we wrote the story. Today, I would have a totally different answer for you, but I'm just kind of taking you through how it started. And this name of Imon came to our mind because it's like you're a man, but you're different. And I'll explain better who they are as we go along. But we needed something because they're not a man, you know, a humanoid, a Homo sapien. They're not that. They're different. And so we needed something. And this, it just kind of came to our mind. It was like a unique type of person called an Imon, which you never heard anywhere, never anywhere on any social search engines or whatever. So we felt that we had something very unique and a unique story. This is even before we realized that it was in Atlantis. So what does it mean? Immortal. That is, if I was pushed to what the I meant, I would say it's immortal because, but it's part of a story that's inherent in the Imon, which doesn't really ever come out. They're not quite immortal. The Imon live 300-400 something years. I have to think about it because you're taking me way back in the past now. But they live hundreds of years, but they're not quite fully immortal, but they're different than us regular people.
And your primary target audience for the book is young adults. So it's young people. Would it be accurate to say that it's about the same age group as, say, the Harry Potter books? In a different way, it's a different kind of story, but it's also fiction and it's also fantasy, right?
Yes, it is. And there's the magazine of the Hollywood, California, the magazine called the Toluquin Times. They did a review on that book, Imon of Atlantis, and they called it a unique world in the tradition of Tolkien. And that was a very nice surprise for us. And that sets the stage. If you like Tolkien, Harry Potter, if you like that sort of fiction fantasy, sit down and send your mind off on a journey, you know, it's that sort of thing. So yes, which is the younger generation, the teenagers, the young adults, this is for them because I think, and you know, when you're at that age, you're more open to fantasy and journey and adventure. At least I was, and the people I knew were. So I feel that that's very, very, that's the target audience, which is great because they, if they find out about me and find out I have a show about how to achieve success a lot faster in your business by listening to the people who've made it and share their wisdom, guidance, and knowledge with you, this is now a beautiful segue into these people who are in college or university and or have just finished or looking what to do or looking what are career-minded. If once they find out about my show and the motivation and inspiration that that provides, that becomes a very successful proposition for me to go from one thing to another and justifiably so. It's just kind of as God sort of put it all in my lap, I just went with it.
Would it surprise you to hear that some data indicates that most of the readers of YA books are actually older women over 50?
It would surprise me. Demographics change. Women generally like these stories, and it generally fits very well with them and what they like, their needs, what they like to do for fun, you know, what they wish their life would be more like. You know, it just seems to appeal. It wasn't written. We never wrote the book for any particular author. Genre or group or demographic. We just wrote it and just let the story unfold, and it just went where it went with all the details and characteristics of it. And I'm very surprised that the woman 50 and above is the target market, not the target market, but a big market for the book. That's very surprising.
I don't know the nuances because, of course, the market is subdivided. So you have YA and you may have fantasy and other romance and other subgroups under the YA. But I have heard in the past that for some of the titles, some of the more successful titles, are their target audience ends up being not young adults as described historically, but that there are a lot of women readers. What amount of time did it take you from conception, so when this friend of yours came to you with the idea, to publication? What would you say that timeline was like?
Years and years and years, because I run a busy schedule and I don't necessarily put a lot of time into it. So when we would get together and work on it or flesh out a story or work out some characters, it was almost like a hobby, but there's a better word for it. It wasn't quite a hobby or a pastime. We knew we were due the book, but there was no time limit on it. It was just when it's done, when it's done, which really made it to be the best that I think it is, because there was no, oh, we want this out for the holiday market or anything. It just didn't matter. When the book is done, when we're happy with it, when we're in love with it, we release it. And that took years and years and years to get it to this point. And we wrote it several times and we rewrote it. And we even did a test market with the book, with the first three books together, but it was just too big. It was almost like 800 pages and we had to keep cutting, and we thought, you know, so we had to develop, what are we going to do? Because it's not something I've done before. If you're talking, again, of a nonfiction book, I've been there, done that, I know what to do. But a fiction was, for myself and the co-author, such a new world. It took a lot of figuring things out. You know, what do people do? What should we do? We had more questions than answers. So it took years and years to put that together.
Your co-author, going by initials, seems to want to remain anonymous. Is that right?
That is correct. My co-author is not on social media, does not appreciate or want anything to do with social media. My co-author, which I'm trying to stay very neutral and in the third person, my co-author just wants to live and enjoy their life the way they like it. And that another reason the co-author came to me for help, because I'm kind of, you know, I'm Italian, so I'm not going to be too critical of myself, but I'm kind of out there. I love social media. I love people. I'm very gregarious. I love to go out. So it was just a, you know, a match made in heaven on that. And yes, my co-author just shies away, though on some of the events that we had in the past year or two, my co-author did attend events and did make and became known just a very tiny, but my co-author just really wants to stay out of the limelight. And so having someone like me as the anchor is probably the best way to have a pen name, or, you know, and to, you know, there's many famous authors that have published under another name. And so this is almost an excuse for my co-author to kind of ride on my coattails a little bit, because I'm all about getting people to know that I'm there because of my podcast. So it kind of worked out for me.
There's a famous Italian author that went by a pen name for a long time before she was found out. Isn't that right?
Oh, I'm sure there was. I don't know particularly know who, but there are so many. There are so many. And they'll write under different names. And sometimes, especially when it comes to fiction, and I'm doing a little bit more guessing here than, you know, I haven't studied and researched it. But when you come out with a fiction book, you don't necessarily know where it's going to go, what it's going to do, what popularity it's going to have, or none. And so you'll like and enjoy that privacy, let's call it, of coming out with another name and having people not know who you are. For example, this is historic now, and people can argue, but that's fine. Do the research. Shakespeare is well known, but Shakespeare is not a real person. I mean, that's just well known. Shakespeare didn't exist, but it was a perfect cover for Francis Bacon to write stories under another name and put it together and have it go out there and live that other life without it coming back, because, you know, he's very political. He worked for the Queen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can research the story. So having that pen name gives you amazing anonymity. And also allows that creative side of you to come out, because I've been cautioned by publishers before on writing a fiction. Believe it or not, I went to a well-known publisher's agent, and he said, "Tony, you can't write fiction." I go, "Why?" He goes, "It's a faux pas in the industry." He goes, "It's just, you just don't want to do it. You don't want that stigma." He goes, "It can come back to bite you." So just don't do it. So that's a very real point. Today may have changed, because times change, trends change, prevailing winds change, but this is how it was then. It was like, don't do it, which is, again, is why it was so important. When the co-author possibility came to me, I thought, this is great, because I can exercise myself in this area, as well as, you know, hopefully, you know, you know, with God's will in place here, attract new audience for my podcast.
There's a lot of controversy raging because of AI among creative people of all kinds, writers and anybody who is creating original content, that because AI is training on human content, as it were, that their content will be stolen and they will not be compensated. You may have heard about the lawsuits that some of the publishing companies have filed against the tech companies. Have you thought about that? How do you feel?
I haven't thought about it. I don't really pay much attention to it, and it doesn't matter to me. If it happens, it happens, and I'm not worried about it. Now that you mention it, and only because you mentioned it, when I said that we did a, call it a treatment or whatnot, we published the first three books together in one big giant volume. Just the first three books, it was like 800 pages, as I mentioned. And we felt it was too much for people to read, so we broke it down now. Well, after that release came the TV series of the famous TV series, I'm trying to think of what it was now, Game of Thrones. And in that, as well as in other stories, we have some material that we feel was taken. We can't prove it, but we have our book that came out publicly before these events occurred. For example, The White Wolves of Balshera. The White Wolves of Balshera, we were surprised when Game of Thrones came out and they had these big giant wolves. It's like, they copied us. They copied us in some of the details, but you can't really prove it. One of these stories, and I'm trying to think of who had a blue flower trail. And that was in our original book on record. It's like, oh my gosh, they copied it. So in the new release, we know it's now a white flower trail because so people wouldn't think we copied somebody else when we were copied. So we see this is happening, and there's nothing we're going to really do about it. We're not, you know, it is what it is. And if people catch it and go, then it opens it up to talking about it and maybe getting more exposure and clarifying it. So I welcome it. If people go, hey, how come you've got white wolves? Then I get a chance like right now and tell the story where so people will see our story came out first. So I don't mind. I'm not asking to be copied or I'm not asking for the AI, but you can only do what you can do, Elena. You know, you can't worry about everything. Just do the best you can and move on. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Well, some people are pulling back from creative endeavors because they're concerned that if they put that out, someone is going to train their AI on their data and it will be stolen. Have you issued or released an audio version, or have you released the books in audio format?
I would like to. Amazon has a beta on it, and I have not been given that opportunity to join in the beta. I would really like to do that. It's quite the endeavor. I mean, you know, consider podcasting and what I do as like a full-time job, you know, full career, do a whole lot. To do the audiobook is quite a bit of work. I do look for options. It would be something I would like to entertain if the right type of the deal and the right option came. Maybe we have to get the book a little bit more notoriety. It's done well, but, you know, maybe I have to go even bigger because it's an expensive proposition as well. So we would like to go there. We've been asked about it. But it's also like saying, hey, there's an empty lot across the street from you, Elena. Let's build a building. You know, that's one sentence. But to do it is a huge endeavor.
How will you measure success now that we're discussing the costs and effort, the many years that it took you? So is it having it published, as an author that I interviewed recently told me that she feels successful already? For her, it doesn't matter what happens. Perhaps that's not, I'm paraphrasing, but that she feels she's already successful because she's accomplished what she set out to accomplish. Or is there a particular accomplishment relating to the book or the books that you think will measure your success, measure success for you?
We don't have any particular KPIs or goals, or I shouldn't, not goals, strike that, levels of, hey, now we're successful. We just made X amount of dollars. We don't have a monetary figure on it. The book, Iman of Atlantis, made number one in multiple countries. It's an international number one bestseller. We're very, very pleased with that. It's been recognized by Amazon. We have the sticker on the book. And we feel that we've hit, if you want to put it in quotes, the level of success. There's higher levels where it would be nice at some point where it would pay for itself, but it's not a criteria. We're doing this because we love it, not because of any monetary or any return. It's a great story. We want to spread the wisdom. There is, there are a number of key points, a small number, let's say, that we would really love society to learn in terms of values and characters and things of that nature. And if people read that and get that, and if we can help even affect a tiny little bit of change, I think that that would be extremely successful. So there's different measurements. It's an expensive proposition to put a book out, depending on how you do it. Yes, you could write it, print it from your computer and send it out. You could do things like that. So it depends on what level. The level that we've chosen with, you know, nice cover and you know, the way it's been published and put out there, there are cost factors associated, and all those are borne by us. And if we're able to recoup that, that would be great, you know. But again, we have no particular criteria. I would just love to hear that people like the story. I would just love to see a little buzz on social media. That we would get a kick out of that. I know it sounds like we're just kind of this ball floating, this cork floating in the ocean, not taking the waves, but it's kind of almost like that, because it's not our full-time job or full-time career. We did it for fun, and we really hope a lot more people enjoy it.
Is there a message? Is there a wisdom that you set out to share in the books?
There is a message and a wisdom that came out when we put all the characters together and we determined it was Atlantis, and we came up with the name for these unique people, which, by the way, we haven't said a word about the story. The message kind of came out itself, because there are forces here, and I probably have to tell a little bit of the story in a summary, where a very fast summary is, picture a samurai warrior. Now, the Aimin are not samurai warriors, but this is the concept. This is before the book started. This is the foundation. And these samurai warriors on the four-island continent of Atlantis in the center of Earth were fierce fighters, and they waged war with each other on all the four island continents until only one race was left. And they were fierce, and they were that type of fighters. And now that they've wiped out all other races, a lot of infighting started, and they started taking each other out. Well, a divine messenger came down and pointed out to them that if they continued on unabated, that they would wipe each other out. And God did not want that. That's not what's wanted in God's creation. So they were given a choice. If they continued fighting, they would wipe each other out. But if they stopped fighting and laid down their weapons, they would be given abilities such as healing. They would be given a longer life and other factors. And help people. So those that didn't heed the divine ultimatum went extinct. Those that did went underground and became the mystical, magical, mythical people of Aimin. Now, this is all before the story starts. So this is not the story. This is just the setting the stage. And now, when the various nations, the Aimin are a myth, a legend. You don't hear of them. But when one is found out as existing, and what they can do, to turn things to gold, can heal, it became now the powers that be were bitten. This is where bitten comes for power, for lust, for gold, and the abilities that the Aimin have. So now the hunt, it becomes a hunt for the Aimin. And it really is. And I know you have the book, and I hope you get a chance to go check it out, because it's there are a lot of twists and turns of what happens. And it even caught us by surprise, because again, we're just starting with characters, and we're just writing the story, and it just keeps developing and developing. And this, it's going to be probably 8 or 9 books book three is out. Book four comes out later this year. There's going to be another couple more books out next year to complete the series. We didn't even know what happens next until we start getting together and writing it. So the message is, you know, there's a level of, you know, the stuff that you hear a lot, but when you read the book, it really shows of, there's a point where character is important. There's a point where your integrity is important. And how far will you go? You know, how far would you go? Would you go as far as our current politicians and heads of states, you know, and current mayors? You read about them in the press, you know. You know, one mayor goes into the office, $6 million in budget. And now, you know, a year or 2 years later, it's all gone and they're $5 million in debt. You know, what happens? There's, what do you do when you have unlimited access to money or you can turn things into gold? What do you do? Where do you go? Where's your level? And these are interesting questions, and everybody that's listening will have their answers to these questions I've just posed theoretically, but it really turns into an amazing concept of, does everyone become corrupt? Does everyone do it? And what happens if someone doesn't want to go that way and says it's wrong? Why? Because it is wrong. No other reason than, you know, what do you do? So these characters, these points started coming out in the story just when we started writing it with no particular plan in mind. And if you have a young child, older child like me, these are great stories because it impresses the power, you know, the power of being yourself and doing what you do that's right and correct, as opposed to being spoon-fed or tricked or trapped into doing something. Because, you know, we have a lot of that happening where various people in high places can be and do get tricked and trapped, and now they're compromised and they have to toe the line. But what happens if you don't want to? You know, then you become the target, then you become chased, you know. So it's very, very interesting. We didn't write this with any plan of what's currently happening now, but when you start reading the story, you would think, wow, Tony's writing about what's happening today. But no, it didn't work out that way. But I really hope that message of righteousness comes through, even though we didn't start off with trying to deliver any message at all. We just wanted to have a good read.
With fewer and fewer people reading, according to the statistics that I have seen, what do you think that means for authors like yourself, for people who are listening to us and thinking, well, I want to be like Tony and I want to write a book?
You know, I must say the biggest joy in writing the book is in writing the book. That joy, when you create it, to every person here in the audience, when you create something yourself, there is a joy in that which is paramount to all other joys. And the fact that, you know, you wrote something, you created something, you did something, you put something together, you have a child, the honor, the pleasure, the wonder, you know, I have a child, or I built something, I built a house, I built a cabinet, I painted a beautiful picture. There's a certain type of joy and love and appreciation which goes beyond, you know, the product or whatever it is that's been created. And I hope that people read the book and enjoy it for the sake and love of reading and enjoyment, you know, and not be so spoon-fed, you know. When I grew up, Elena, kids would do something you don't see today really in cities or suburbs. They played in the streets. We played in the streets. We played hide and seek. We played tag. We played all sorts of stuff. If there were no kids, we'd pick up a rock. We'd pick up a stick and we would play with it. Not so more today. Today they have these little devices with black screens glued to their faces, you know, or their hands. And somebody else is doing the imagination for them. And this is why you didn't mention the question, but this is why the Island of Atlantis is never going to go into a movie series. At least that's the plan. We don't want it. We don't want a movie on this. We want the imagination. And for a while, we didn't even release pictures of what they look like. And then we thought, you know, just a little bit. So we released a picture on Ivan. It's in my newsletter. We released a picture on Queen Bela. We released a picture on Roni. She's the Iman who is now the subject of pursuit.
This is the one that the ogre wants to catch because she makes gold?
Yes. So if you go to my newsletter, if I can say, go to tonyduruso.substack.com. Get my newsletter. You can see all the past newsletters. In the newsletters, I have stories of the individual characters. I felt that was good. So we started talking about the characters. Last newsletter, a couple newsletters ago, we put Raiden. Raiden is the Imperial Knight, and he is the senior as a brother to Ivan, and he trained him. He trained him to fight. He trained him to hunt. And, you know, so we started putting the characteristics of each character, who they are, what they like, what they're about, and their picture, and what they're really nice images of them to help our readers move along and better visualize and use your own imagination as to what happens. And we'll see what we do with coming up with a picture of Bomo, who is the ogre in our book. He's a big, big person with his yellowy eyes, and we'll see what happens with that. But it lends to the imagination instead of taking it away. Instead of spoon feeding you what to think, I want you to now think and expand your mind. Is that a good way to say it? Expand your imagination, expand your own horizons. And I would love to see more of that happen.
Is there a subscription fee for your newsletter on Substack?
No, it's totally free. There is people can contribute and pay whatever, $5 or $8 a month if they want or not. But there's a column that just says free, and you get everything. And you even get my community resources. You get in the free. You get the vision map. You get the critical mistakes you don't want to make in social media. You get a chapter out of my book, The Disciplined CEO, and you're going to get some more stuff, all totally free. I'm just building my community. I've had a community all over the place, and I like a lot of the features that I have on Substack, and it just kind of works well the way it's been all put together. So yeah, it's totally free. Doesn't cost you a penny to read about the Iman characters and read about other things as well, because in the newsletter I have, you know, books that I like, I have podcasts that I like. I do promote others and say, hey, here, these are some great podcasts. So there's a band that has some really good music, and I put some snippets there. So it's a little eclectic in the newsletter, but just a little bit where I do some shout outs. So I think it will appease please people of a wide demographic nature.
Why Substack and not, say, your own website?
The ability to bring everybody together. There are a lot of computer tools that you have to build or develop to come up with a newsletter. And I've tried different things over the years. I've tried sending out my own email newsletters and using companies, and I've tried many, many things. And the facilities and features of Substack are just so convenient. It was just such a nice plugin. I really, really enjoy it, and it's like I found something that works. It took me a decade, but I don't know when they came out, but when I started hearing about them, they do things that I cannot do on my website, and there's no charge. It's all plug and play. Substack makes their money like if someone gave me $8, then Substack takes a commission. So that's how they make their money, and they're strong. They're in business, and I'm grateful that they provide these tools to us. So it's TonyDuruso www.substack.com. And yeah, and all my newsletters are there. And I encourage you to go scan through and see all the pictures of all the unknown characters.
You seem to also feel very comfortable on social media. Which channels are you on?
I'm really glad that you asked that question, because I feel a little bit vocal on that. There are probably 22,396 different social media platforms out there, and they keep coming up, and I get invites and free access to social media platforms one after the other after the other. But there's only so much you can do, Elena. And the one key platform I like that I use, which I'm going to surprise you, is the one that all the heads of state in the world use. And it's the one that's going down in a big flame, which is the one called Twitter. And I'm in the six digits on in Twitter with followers. It's taken me years to build that. And even though they changed the name and different things have changed, it still is a great place. There are new social media platforms that do better than what Twitter did. But really, do I want to spend 10 years getting 200,000 followers or whatever it's going to take? No, I'll stick with the followers that I have. So for me, it worked out very, very well. And the next best one is, since we're all business people, I'm going to give this as an imperative. Get on LinkedIn if you're not. Follow me at, just look up my name, Tony D-U-R-S-O. Join me on LinkedIn. It is the number one place you want to be as a professional for your career, for your business, whether you're a solopreneur, whether you're a business owner of a multi-billion dollar company. LinkedIn has so many benefits. I could do a whole show just on touting the features and why it's so important to be on LinkedIn. So those are the two that I'm on. I answer all of my messages personally. I don't believe in having anybody hired to do, though I've done it before. I've tried it and it just doesn't work. The person that knows the best answers about my business is me, and I'm just going to stick with that, even though people can argue and do whatever they want. Those are some of the best ones for me, for my needs, for my purpose. And I reach a lot of people on Twitter, so I'm very pleased that that's working and that the company hasn't people of, on both sides and all walks will say different things about them, that it's an impending doom, it's a time bomb, it's going to, you know, disappear, whatever. But it has a lot of clout, and I think that's really important. If you're not on Twitter, in the audience here, where are you the biggest? Where are you making the most impression? Where are you getting the best responses? Then grow that. That's the one you should grow. If it's some austere name, and there's a lot of them, I'm not going to start promoting everybody just yet, but there are all sorts of great social media platforms out there that do so many things. And if you've got thousands and thousands of engaging followers, grow that. That's what, because it's all about growing a community and having followers and sharing your knowledge. And I'm grateful that I can do that on LinkedIn and Twitter and grow. And I try to write articles on LinkedIn, and I publish articles and posts on LinkedIn about business and my shows and Elite Entrepreneurs. So it just works out really, really well. So those are two of the key places I think that you would really want to make sure you have a good presence on.
What are the do's and don'ts?
Ooh, you've now gone into some new territory. Some of the do's and don'ts on social media, which is what I believe Elena is asking about. There are critical mistakes that you want to avoid. And I'm going to give you this information because, just like you in the audience here, I spent years, I tested, I I was, you know, went into services that would grow my followers, and I tried everything, and all with the purpose of, hey, I podcast, I want you to listen to my podcast, I want you to buy my books, I want you to follow me on my website, I want you to follow me on Twitter, you know, I have sponsors, I want you to buy their stuff, etc. So I've become like a walking commercial, which you kind of do when you podcast. And how much can I say to how many people, you know? And so it becomes like, well, what do you say and how much do you say? So I've learned a couple of key things. And mistake number one. When I first got into podcasting, one of my early on guests, and this, you know, I remember this so well, this guest insisted throughout the interview that I keep giving a URL for this. And then the guest would talk about something and insist I'd give out the URL for that. And I don't have any criteria. You, when you come on my show, you're welcome to give out a URL. It's no biggie. But I was a little blindsided on it, Elena, because the guest gave me four URLs. And after the interview, the guest was unhappy. Now, the guest did not pay to get on my show. I spent all this time, my own money, my own effort to put the guest on my show, interview the guest, promote it, and the guest didn't get any responses or what's called leads. And the guest was disappointed with me. How about that? You do something free for somebody, you give them your heart and soul, and they're disappointed, but it actually happened. Another guest who only shared one URL went on my show. And that guest, unbeknownst to me, well, I eventually found out, started raving on social media about all the clicks and all the phone calls that the guest got from our interview. And this guest said, Tony's show is the best I ever been on. I got more phone calls than I could imagine. What a great show. It was really nice. Now, I did all this again for free for the guest, and it was really nice to see someone appreciate what I did. And it really taught me how simplicity is so important. You know, I've given a couple of URLs on this episode. I try not to, you know, be that walking commercial, but I've learned that if you stay focused on one thing, because people can have a limited attention span, and I don't know how true that is, but we keep hearing it, but does that mean that it's true? But if you just push one thing or say one thing, it really sticks out. And that's what I've learned. And when I, in using that, when I promote my own show in my own commercials, I usually just only tell people go to tonyduruso.substack.com, because that's where my newsletter is, that's where my free giveaways are, and it makes it very, very simple. I don't tell you to join me on LinkedIn and Twitter and give out all the URLs and all these places, because there's only so much you can do. Now, it sounds good. Oh, yeah, give me all your URLs. Oh, here's five of them, you know. Give me all your social medias, you know, here's 10 of them. The person listening isn't normally going to get it all, but you will walk away from this episode, and you know how to spell my last name, D-U-R-S-O, because I've said it a few times. And I try to just keep that very, very simple. So if you get to the point where you're a walking commercial, which I joke about myself, you know, that way, you will really appreciate, you've heard it, to be simple, that's part of it, to just give out one thing, because you're not going to be everything to everyone. People are listening to your podcast. You're driving right now. You're walking your dog. You're exercising. You're cooking in the kitchen. You're watching news on TV, which you have turned down, and you're listening to my voice on this podcast with Elena. So there's only so much that the person is going to remember and walk away with, but they'll know how to spell D-U-R-S-O. So that's social media critical mistake number one. Just keep yourself simple. When you're out there, when you're being interviewed or you're interviewing others, think about what I just said. Pause and think. Okay, mistake one. Mistake number two. Mistake number two, and I touched upon this briefly, but now I'm going to expand on it. Elena, you and I, we want to be the social media king and queen and king and media lion of our day. We want everyone to love us. We want everyone to follow us. At least you would think that that's why we're on social media, is we have something important to say. We want people to know about it. And I'm raising both my hands, not just one. We get roped into, or not tricked is not direct, goaded, excited, enthused into joining the next new great social media platform that's just come out there. It's the hottest, it's the latest, it's the coolest, it's wonderful. And guess what? It's free, and you can join right now because it's limited time only. Elena, come on and join this new platform. And it's like, there's thousands and thousands of these. You know, as I joked earlier, saying there's like 28,000. And so the question to you, Elena, and to everyone in the audience, how much time do you really want to spend on these social media platforms? You know, you want to grow them all? You know, I'm just going to start naming things. And you know, there's Snapchat, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, personal Facebook, and there's a business Facebook. How about that? There's two. There's TikTok, there's YouTube, there's Rumble, there's BitChute, there's Instagram. And it just goes on and on and on. How many hours a day or week, how many hours are you going to spend on all these? It's just too much. And I'll give you, and I'm going to really go granular on this. Well, not granular, but I'm going to go more deep. One day I tested something. I spent 3 hours. All I did was answer messages on Facebook. From 9 to noon, all I did was answer messages. Can you believe that? I spent 3 hours just answering messages. And at the end of 3 hours, I thought, did anyone listen to my show? No. Did anyone give me a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify for my show? No. Did anyone join me on my social media platform? No. Did anyone buy my book? No. Did anyone use my services or buy my services? No. So I thought about this, and I thought, I spent all this time. What did I get? All this time answering messages of people trying to sell me things or get something from me, because there's a preponderance of that on social media. And I thought about that, and I thought, I could have done more things with that time. And so I've changed in how I do things. And I realized I need to be more focused on the social media platforms that I am on, which I talked about earlier. And that's how I grew my Twitter to in the six digits. That's how I have several hundred thousand followers, because I focus on just the key ones and grow that and be more engaging. So I say to you, mistake number two, don't try to be a kingpin or the queen on every social media platform. Push and pitch your tent, if you want to look at it, in one place and grow from where you are. Take your biggest social media that you have right now, whatever the name is. It could be a line, it could be Blue Sky, it could be Medium, whatever it is. If it's your biggest, keep it. Grow that and grow your audience, because it's all about growing the community, sharing your likes, sharing what's important to you, and so forth. And it kind of, that attitude, Elena, gets you a little bit away from this, I don't even know what to call it anymore, this AI pitch fest where you're being fed and bombarded with so many AI things. I just try to keep it very real. And that's an important part of it, which we'll probably go into a little bit more in mistake number three. But so far, so good. Any questions on that, or should I go into the third?
Go ahead.
By the way, I really enjoy talking about this. I have a passion in social media. All right. Mistake number three. This is the worst. Underline that. Make it in bigger letters. The worst mistake ever. And it's, I think, was the toughest lesson to learn. Now, let's start with what we're trying to do. Well, you want to be big in social media. You want to have big numbers. You want to be able to put out a post and say, hey, you know, buy this chewing gum and bring sponsors. You know, when you podcast, you know what it means to have a sponsor. in your business. You know what it means to advertise and get people to want your business. So these are important to every single person. It's, you know, sell somebody's products or represent someone's products, be their ambassador, or your own products. So these are very, very, very important. Okay. So mistake number three, this is a doozy, is there are companies, yes, a lot, that will give you these super numbers on your social media. Hey, we'll get you 10,000 people in 30 minutes. $50. Oh, wow, that's wonderful. And when you think about it, you know, you get caught up in the pitch. Wow, I can have 10,000 more people in 30 minutes. God, I could have 1 million people by the end of this month. And when you think about it, Elena, you're like, okay, well, this is great. But wait. How are 10,000 people going to know about Tony, you know, D-U-R-S-O? How are they going to know about Tony D-U-R-S-O here? Do they even know who I am? How does this happen? So when you, and there's packages of all types. Well, when you buy the package, you know, first of all, every social media platform, they have their way of telling you if the follower is a fake. You know, you can tell if they engage, you know. And I know a big podcaster. I learned this lesson. You might say, Tony, we know this lesson. And I'm going to say, I learned the hard way. I was following a major podcaster, bigger than my show. And one day, this podcaster was gone off social media. Now, this is a big person, every household name in podcasting. And it's like, this person's not on social media. What happened? Person's banned, gone. No more. And I was like, what happened? And there was no place to read about it, no place to find out. But I remember, because I did follow this person, that the person was growing in social media leaps and bounds and taller than tall buildings and just boom, 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 and really rocking. And it came to mind, because it was being pitched so much at the time by other companies, that this person had to wind up and following and aggressively went after getting followers, got sold some package. And what happens when you do that, you can tend to get banned from the social media companies. If you start buying, quote, followers, end quote, that can happen. And I know someone else that bought an aggressive package. And I was able to tell that they were all fake. So,
what is it called, Tony? An aggressive package?
An aggressive package to get followers.
Is that like a thing?
No. If I promised you 10,000 followers by the end of this week, and you pay me $500, and you would think, oh wow, I'd get 10,000 more people on my Instagram for $500, I'll do it. That's very aggressive. Is it really somebody knows 10,000 real people that they're going to introduce you to that is going to now follow you on Instagram? You see what I'm talking about?
Yes, I just didn't know that it was aggressive package.
Oh, yeah, it's that's what I call it. I call it that. And I found that the people that are doing this, because I speak to podcasters and those that are aggressively growing their followers by buying packages, they're not getting anywhere. They're not getting what they thought that they would get. And, another way that these companies do it is they'll say, well, we'll get you real people. What we do is we will follow 10,000 people this month. And then they'll come on and follow you back. And then next month we unfollow them and follow 10,000 other people, like a bait and switch. And that's just wrong. So you're going to follow people and make people think Tony D'Urso wants to know about them. And then once they follow me back, then you're going to unfollow them. What's the point of that? So it's deceptive. And there's all these people that say, and I'm being very general now, let's say that they're experts and specialists. I just consider all that stuff deceptive. I don't do that. I think that's mistake number three. I think it's the biggest thing. I won't do that. I say, don't let someone you don't know control your social media. I don't care if it's a penny. I don't care if they give me the first 6 months free. If I don't know them, if I don't know how they're really doing social media to grow my followers, I won't go there, you know? And there are right and correct ways to do it. And I'm able to grow my Twitter followers very simply, very inexpensively. I know certain ways of how to do things by getting in front of real followers. And these companies have ceilings as well. If you grow too fast, now you get on their radar, you get banned, you get issues. And if you really value that social media, I just stay away from all that. And that's what's I've seen so much of it. You may say, Tony, you've never heard of it. You may not, but I've seen so much of it that I'm considering the biggest mistake ever is I will not put my, hey, I worked hard to get several hundred thousand people to find out about me. I'm not going to hand that over to somebody who says he can grow it or she can grow it. I'm just not going to do that because it's a matter of trust and really knowing the person. So if you're going to have somebody do something on your social media, just really think that through and don't do this follow, unfollow stuff. I think it's deceptive. Don't do it. That's mistake
number three.
So don't cheat.
What you're saying is don't cheat.
Well, it's not cheating. Elena, if you know, you're on social media, go, and I follow you, go, wow, Tony follows me. You know, it's times it by, you know, 10,000. And then you follow me back. And then because now that you follow me back, I unfollow you. I might be talking fast. I'm Italian, so I say things fast, maybe. Unfollow. So now I'm no longer following you because I no longer care what you're saying anymore. Because now that you're following me, that was all that I care about. So I consider that deceptive.
Does it matter when you're selecting your channel that it be the place where your primary target audience is? For example, you said that your two preferred channels are LinkedIn and Twitter. Those are generally, let's say, adult channels, meaning it's a business channel, certainly for LinkedIn, and Twitter is also known as an adult channel. Let's say a lot of media are present on Twitter versus, say, a teenage channel, which may be, I don't know what it is today, TikTok, let's say, or Instagram, where you have a more youthful audience. Is that important? If those are not channels where you are present, does that matter?
If it depends on one, your purpose, what is it you're trying to accomplish? Are you growing because you have a product or service or a podcast or something you want people to know about, or a book or whatever? And if so, where do they hang? And if you're not on social media already, then where do these people hang out? Where do you have to go to talk to them? Where do you have to go to meet them? What is it that you want to do? These are some questions, if you're just starting out, that you need answered. You need to answer to know where to go. If you are already on social media, I say the low-hanging fruit is take wherever you are and have the biggest audience. And I say audience, people that are engaging with you, you're talking to them. They like what your book or your podcast or your whatever your company does, or they like chewing gum or whatever it is that's your passion. Then grow that. Why go try? It's the bird in hand story. Why go try something that you heard might be better, but you don't know that. You know, you may have I'm just going to make this up. It's true too. I love orchids. I love talking about orchids. I'm impressed and amazed with orchids. I could do an orchid YouTube channel. And I love talking about orchids. So I have my Facebook page. I talk about orchids. I'm just theorizing. I talk about orchids and I have orchid lovers coming, and I'm happy with that. I don't need to go to LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram particularly. So it all depends. What is it that you want to do, and where are your followers now? And or are you not getting what you want? You know, I may be posting about my orchids on Facebook, and I'm not getting the satisfaction. So I'll try posting on Instagram and TikTok. I'll try those two and see if I can get a better mix or better connection with people about my passion. It all depends on what you want to do. I think a lot of people on social media, I think general, foundational, talk about what resonates with you, your passion, and that's what you're going to connect. You're going to connect and have people resonate with. It's what you like. It's your passion. There's a difference between, hey, you know, I'm pushing this sponsor and I'm pushing this sponsor and I'm talking about this and I'm talking about that. It's different than, I love this book, The Island of Atlantis. I love talking about old world Atlantis and Tony and where do I think it is? And that's passion. Now I'm driven by passion and love. I love this topic. I really, really do. So where can I talk about it? And so try a couple social media platforms. And again, I'm easy to reach. I'm welcome. Comment, you know, my Substack has a comment section, you know, people can comment and I can get comments and answer back. So I really just like the way that they did it, and I didn't have to reinvent that to put it on my website. So if you have comments, if you have a passion about Atlantis, you know, reach out to me there. But hopefully that answers your question of, it all kind of really depends, what is it you're trying to accomplish?
Let's go back to the book for a second. There, you said that it's a fantasy and, well, we know it's a fantasy, but as I recall you describing at the beginning, there was a lot of warring. So are there advisories? Is there foul language? Are there gory details? Is there torture? What do we need to know?
It's kid-friendly. There's no swearing in the book. Everything is, you know, if you go to the movie ratings, everything is PG, you know, PG rating. The warring and everything that happened on a massive scale was before the book started. And there are scenes where some of the bad guys go after the good guys, and, you know, there's scenes where some people are in prison or get a sword in them, but nothing graphic, nothing gory, nothing near anything that you see in today's cartoons, which I think are pretty graphic and gory.
And it's a series of 7, 3 of which have been published. I have titles 1 and 2 here, and there are a total of 7 that is the series, is that correct?
We believe we're going to get into 8 or 9. We haven't finished the last book and published, and we have a couple that are written that are now going to go out and get produced. And these are costly endeavors that we are covering ourselves. They're costly.
So you're self-publishing, Tony?
I use a company, but the costs involved, somebody's got to pay for them, and there's a lot of expenses on getting the book out, a high quality product book like what we have. It's expensive. There's no doubt about it, and we're not cutting corners. That's another reason it takes time. We just published Pursuit Volume 3 in February, and later this year, in another couple of months. By the end of this year, I hope to get Volume 4 out, called Scattered. And then another 2 or 3 the next year, or maybe the rest of the series next year. We'll see. If we have four books out, another 4 books probably could finish the series. We'll see when we get to the final story part.
Can you read a book by itself as a standalone story? Can you read them out of order, or do you have to read all of the books to get the story, and do you have to read them in the order in which they were published?
You should read them in the order because it's one big story. It's huge. It's a huge story. And the only way to make sense of it is to start at book one and go through. And each story builds on and talks about what just happened and goes further. So I highly recommend the best way to read the book is from the first page. First book, first page.
What three tips would you share with our listeners who are listening to us and think, there's a book in my heart that I want to publish? What three tips would you share with them?
Three tips. One, write it. Two, write it. Three, write it. I'm Italian. I'm silly. First tip is, if you have a story, start working out who are the characters. I say the word characters. I don't know that that's the word that people use anymore. Who are the people involved in the book? I call them characters. What are they? What are their characteristics? Well, they mean they're happy, they're sad, they're tall, they're short, they're blonde, they're, who are they? Start writing out descriptions of these people and get their personalities in place. As soon as you get their personalities in place, you now start having ideas as to how they are going to interact with others, their monologue. You know, when we wrote about Queen Tara, oh my gosh, you have never met someone, I don't think, as evil and conniving as Queen Tara. You just haven't. We put that in her characteristics and personality. That's tip one. Tip two, when you start writing about your characters and personality, you're welcome to use real people that you know and take some of their characteristics. For example, Queen Tara. We know, I'm going to be very generic and very kind, we know people, I'm talking to co-author and I, we know people with those characteristics that have done those things. You know, I know I'm hitting super generalities here. Probably it's going to come out in the second book. But Queen Tara was so evil. You know, when she would visit the queen, or, you know, her husband, the king's mother, she was poisoning her and she was dying. And she was, every time she went to visit her, give her more poison, was taking jewelry away from her.
And you know people who have done this?
Not the poison part. Yeah. Yeah. So take, and I'll give you another one. Take people that you know and their personalities and write them into the characters. For example, Bomo is a character in our book who's an ogre. He's a human, but he's so big and so strong and dumb in a way that the best fitting choice words are an ogre. Well, we know somebody that's Bomo. We know this person. And Bomo, when Bomo gets in a rage, Bomo's strength is unnatural. And so we borrowed that from this person. When this person gets mad and picks up a car and moves it over because that person's in this person's parking spot, or when this person hits his head on a cabinet in the office kitchen and just rips the cabinet off the wall. That's unnatural superhuman strength. So we put some of these characteristics in our people. I'm not trying to badmouth anyone or say anything, but use people's characteristics. We know somebody like Prince Ivan, who cares more about integrity and doesn't care about money. And it just doesn't matter. He has a line that he draws and he won't cross it. So use people that you know. This will make for a very fun book. Use people that you know and stories about them and weave that characteristic, that personality trait into the book. And we've weaved quite a few of these in our book, which makes these characters come to life. And you may read it and go, you when you read, it's like, if I transpose that into modern times with this modern person, it was like, wow, that's amazing. You know, so that will really, really help you in your character development. Once you have your character development, and you're going to have more characters in your book. As we wrote our book, we have more characters. Michiko, he hasn't come out yet in the first three books. He has actually come out in the third book. Michiko, I'm not going to say much more about him. He's an amazing person of a character and a level of respect that's just almost unparalleled. Well, we know people like that. So we wrote that into Michiko's character. And it makes the book come alive. It really, really does. So those are a couple good tips. I could keep talking about it, but those are some things. And also, if you have a place for them, a home. Like when we wrote The Island of Atlantis, when we started, we didn't have a home. We didn't know where Atlantis. Who knows where Atlantis is? We don't know. But what caught my attention, Elena, is that there are old world maps in the center of Earth. The famous ones are from Mercator. It's a four-island continent in the center of Earth. And that's interesting. And it's on hundreds of maps, old world maps. It's on hundreds. But today, in the 60s, growing up, that territory was relegated to just pure ice. And today, you go on your maps, it's just water. So it doesn't even exist. And I thought that's fantastic. Because now I have a land that once was, no longer is, and it's free real estate. So I took that, and we took the northeast quadrant, and we drew out the map of Atlantis, which is where the story sets. And so have a home. And for us, it worked out because we used a place that once existed that's no longer on maps, and so it worked out to our advantage. So if you have a territory of where your characters are, then really, really helps. So after you work out your personalities, who's who, what's what, work out where they are, and then just use that little, let's call it a trick or, you know, when you come up with a new character, well, who are they? Oh, that's my Aunt Sally. That's my Uncle Tony. That's, you know, that's Elena. That's whatever personality. Put that in that character. Makes them come to life. And I think when you yourself, Elena, read Bitten, you're going to see that, how real some of these people are. And that's I'm really grateful that we're able to do that. And I think that that's exactly why we were able to do it.
Tony, thank you for joining us from Crescent City, California.
Elena, it's such a pleasure to be out here. I really enjoyed asking about it. I hope we bring some joy to others in reading the Island of Atlantis series. Reach out to me on my community page on Substack if you wish and talk to me. I would love to get your, communicate with you.
And to our audience, you have been listening to Tony D'Urso, who is author of Island of Atlantis, Bitten, who discussed how he became a fiction writer. To propose a guest for the show, you can email me directly at editor@hispanicmpr.com. That's editor@hispanicmpr.com.